A moment of peace for Aleppo today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Syria's ceasefire is not perfect, but for people in Aleppo, it's still a huge relief.
Even children, this is the first time they could play, laugh, run without looking into the sky because they were always afraid and scared of the planes that target this area.
Also, a former refugee remembers his own perilous journey. Now he wants to help others by making a drone that collects life-saving information about migrant boats.
And sharing those in real time with people that are search and rescue professionals, this is very crucial, I think, and that's what we're doing.
Plus, the rule that forces young tennis players in the U.S. to speak only English on the court. That's all ahead today here on The World. Thank you for being with us today, and we're going to start with Syria's ceasefire. To call it fragile is probably an understatement. It's only been in effect since Monday, but there have been reports of dozens of violations of the ceasefire from both sides. The U.S. and Russia, who brokered the deal, say that the hardest part is separating terrorists from moderate rebel groups in Syria. Journalist Theo Padnos was held by one of those rebel groups for more than 2 years. In a few minutes, he'll talk about how quickly moderates can morph into extremists in Syria. But first, the view from two parts of the war-torn Syrian city of Aleppo. Abdel Kafi teaches English at the University of Aleppo. He lives in the rebel-held portion of the city and says the ceasefire is a welcome break.
Fortunately, we don't hear those horrific sounds that we used to hear every day, every morning, every night. The sounds of planes, bombs, shelling. I think for the first time I could go out with my wife here in the streets. Even children, this is the first time they could play, laugh, run without looking into the sky because they were always afraid and scared of the planes that target this area.
I know you have a baby daughter. Has she been able to go outside and see the sky? Because that was one thing when we last spoke. You were really upset about that. She couldn't go outside.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. This is one of the most beautiful moments for me because I could go with my daughter and with my wife outside. We could have sunlight.
This has all got to be a big relief, even if it's just one day so far.
They were very, very fantastic moments for me. This is a rest, okay, for us. We deserve such things.
What about life on the streets and in the markets of Aleppo right now? With the ceasefire holding so far, are people moving about?
There are a lot of people in the streets. They are walking. Most of people are walking with their families. For the first time, I could see the normal life in our streets. And even now, I can see people walking in the streets here. I'm sitting on my balcony. Really, I feel this is what they deserve, okay? Just to feel as people who are outside live, without fear, without being scared, without looking into the sky. But now it's different. People have fun.
Are you also nervous, too, though, about violations of the ceasefire? I mean, there have been ceasefires before and they haven't held very well.
Until now, it succeeded, okay? It works, the ceasefire. But we're not sure if it will work and it will succeed in the next few days. They are now talking about aid that are coming into Aleppo. And most people, by the way, I want to tell you that most people here inside Aleppo are not satisfied with this aid. They don't want to let this aid come into Aleppo.
The people of Aleppo are protesting the arrival of aid. Is that what you said?
Yes, they are protesting about the arrival of aid because, first of all, this is not a revolution of hunger. This is a revolution of freedom. When they have a deal, for example, the U.S. and Russian deal, it's talking always about food. What about the most important thing that we want? Freedom, our freedom. Here, some people here now prefer death to back to slavery of Assad. Now they make the picture of the regime, the Assad regime, beautiful. That he's helping people. No, what is the beautiful picture after sieging Aleppo? Now, this is what Assad regime and UN, by the way, UN is a partner for Assad regime for doing this. This makes all the people here don't trust the UN at all.
So what you're saying is people in Aleppo are so angry with the UN for essentially supporting Bashar al-Assad that if food trucks came to Aleppo with that aid, the people would say, we don't want it.
Exactly. This is again a slavery to Assad again. No. Here some people now prefer death to have such things. It's a kind of a humiliation.
Abdel, thanks very much for being with us today. We wish you and your family well.
Thank you very much. You're welcome.
One view from Aleppo there. That was Abdel Kafi, an English teacher living in the rebel-held part of the city. For another view, let's head to the other side of Aleppo with my BBC colleague, Jeremy Bowen.
This is the west side of Aleppo, controlled by the government. Many more have died on the east side, but the pain of death crosses the battle lines. Not much else unites a country that the war has left in fragments. A soldier showed me a shell improvised by rebels. He said they pack empty cooking gas bottles with explosives, weld on a tail, and fire them from homemade mortars.
You hear a lot of that?
Many, many, many. By hundred, by thousand infijarat.
Hundreds, thousands of explosions.
Very much.
It was a small violation of the ceasefire, but Salat Balad is haunted by years of shelling and by his grandchildren's fears. He calls rebels terrorists. He lost an eye and his son a leg to a gas bottle attack.
The murder. This is murder. Killers. They killed the children and the women. We don't know what happened to Syria.
One day the war will end and peace will start with a ceasefire.
C'est dangereux un peu, oui.
Father Elias Adas, a Maronite priest, a Christian, hopes that day has come. Rebels destroyed his church. Many Syrian Christians support the regime. Father Elias believes only negotiation will end the war. He backs the ceasefire and believes pouring more weapons into the Middle East leads to disaster.
From this church, I call on all the countries of the world to stop the arms trade. The money spent on weapons could feed many people and build a civilization of peace.
That was Father Elias Adas ending that report from the BBC's Jeremy Bowen in the government-held part of Aleppo. Theo Padnos is someone else with direct experience of Syria's war. He's a journalist and for almost 2 years was held captive by Jabhat al-Nusra, an al-Qaeda affiliate. He was released in August 2014. A documentary about his ordeal is coming out next month. It's called Theo Who Lived. Theo Padnos is pleased to see the ceasefire holding in parts of Syria, but he sees little buy-in to the process from the Syrians he's in touch with on the ground. Padnos says the process of identifying so-called moderate rebel groups is a tricky proposition.
I know hundreds of Jabhat al-Nusra members who would be delighted to present themselves as moderates to the U.S. government or to whoever else is handing out weapons. You know, they're extraordinarily capable and good talkers, and if a gun is in the works, they're going to say what they have to say to get the gun, and then those guns are going to be used against, well, God knows who. A weapon entitles you to status in the culture at the moment. It entitles you to followers if you have enough of a weapon. Like the thing that everybody wanted when I was there was a Dushka. It means a little soul. It's a Russian, like 50 caliber machine gun that you can sometimes shoot down airplanes with. Now, a person who has this is entitled to a certain degree of latitude. Like nobody can really tell them what to do. And they want more and more and more of these things. The more guns they have, the more followers they have. So their agenda with that gun is up to them as soon as we give it to them.
It sounds like what you're saying is that when Syrians claim allegiance to groups, these extremist groups, that allegiance is pretty fluid. Am I wrong?
That's right. I mean, it depends on who has the falafel in the kitchen today and who has the bullets for that guy's gun today. And, you know, maybe tomorrow the next guy in the next kitchen has a better falafel. That's how it works. It's like I can be your friend today, but tomorrow maybe not. And really, I'm going to be looking out for my own interests, which is quite reasonable. These people have families to protect. They have, you know, their own survival to be concerned with. And I think that when we negotiate with commanders, we don't always know who they are commanding, and they themselves don't always know.
Give us an example, maybe something that you saw of this allegiance shifting.
For instance, my group, Jabhat al-Nusra, many of the commanders have younger brothers. Those people are soldiers. When ISIS came into the area in which I was held prisoner for a year, Deir ez-Zor, they would try to seduce the younger brothers away from the elder brothers so that the families would be divided. There would be half of the family on Jabhat al-Nusra, half of the family on ISIS, and the project of the two groups was to kill each other. It was quite insane, but this is how the allegiances can slide. These labels mean more to us than they mean to the people on the ground.
Are you still in touch with people in Syria, specifically the people who held you captive?
Yes.
How
we
do
chat
this conversation?
On Facebook, we chat on any social media.
And what do you chat about?
How's it going, man? What's going on? What happened to Abu Hamza? Where's he these days? Oh, he got martyred. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
The people who held you captive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And some of them, I mean, I want to say like good luck to that guy because he was nice to me. And some of them I want to say, I never liked that guy. I'm interested in what is happening inside the jihad in Syria.
Yeah. What are they telling you? What is happening now? Are they confident about their future?
In pain. And the jihad people are suffering. I talk to the regime people every day. They're suffering too.
Theo, before you go, I'd really like you to leave us with an anecdote, a sketch of someone perhaps that you met or maybe somebody you even still communicate with in Syria who just kind of illustrates the moral complexity
okay.
of what's going on.
Sure. Thank you. That's a good question. I'm in touch with a fellow prisoner who is now living in the Islamic State. I don't know what his role is in this Islamic State.
Okay.
This guy was a Jabhat al-Nusra commander who had been imprisoned by his own colleagues because he was suspected of wanting to defect to ISIS.
And you knew him?
He was in my cell.
And today he is in the Islamic State fighting for ISIS?
He appears to be in a position of authority within that organization. And what he wants to do at this point is to help the civilians. Perhaps he's also killing civilians. I don't know. But there are some civilians he wants to help. Now, I think this is the case with all sides. They want to help their own civilians. And they want to kill the other people. If we give him a ton of Band-Aids, I think he'd give them out. I think we should cultivate that side to this guy. Rather than just bombing him to death, because where this guy came from, there are 10,000 more. There are 100,000 more.
Theo Padnos, thanks very much for coming into the studio.
Thank you very much.
Journalist Theo Padnos was held captive by Jabhat al-Nusra, an al-Qaeda affiliate, for almost 2 years. He was released in 2014. Time to change up the mood a bit. This is new music from Kenya, just out this week, in fact. Sauti Sol is the name of the band, one of the biggest pop acts in Kenya, but the track they just put out takes them back to their roots, when they started as an a cappella group at their old high school in Nairobi. So, like all successful alums, they went back to their alma mater, Upper Hill School, and gave this year's school choir some motivation by recording a song with them. It's called Kuliko Jana, and in the last 36 hours, a video of the performance has gotten more than 30,000 views on YouTube. Bwana ni mokozi wangu, tena ni kiongozi wangu, ananipenda leo kuliko jana. We've got Sauti Sol's a cappella video up on our Facebook feed. It's really stunning. You should check it out. Just look for The World on Facebook. The song Kuliko Jana from the Kenyan band Sauti Sol, singing along with the choir at their old Nairobi High School. Just ahead, green energy gets its own incubator right here in Boston on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Remember that big climate agreement hammered out in Paris last winter? Well, for now, it's still just a bunch of paper. But UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is expected to push for putting it into effect before the end of the year, maybe even as soon as next week during the UN's General Assembly in New York. The U.S. and China formally committed to the agreement a couple of weeks ago, but it still needs a bunch more countries to officially adopt it before it can go into effect. Those signatures, though, would really just be the beginning of the massive global effort we'll need to avoid the most dangerous effects of climate change. New technologies can help help us get off fossil fuels, but we'll need new businesses to help develop those technologies. One approach that's been gathering steam is something called the Green Business Incubator. We sent the world's Jason Margolis and Ari Daniel to check out the nation's largest green business incubator. Turns out it's not too far from our studios.
Boston's spot as a hub of green energy innovation had an unlikely start. Sareen Grama had just finished his graduate work at MIT and was looking for a place to work on his new solar electricity startup. He came across an old, abandoned warehouse.
My partner and I were looking at it, well, it's a lot of space here. Maybe other people can join. It's kind of lonely, so let's see if other people are interested. We put out a call to the MIT community.
Within weeks, a handful of startups were sharing that cavernous space.
And we bonded. All the companies sort of created a nice community, and we were starting sharing tools and people and ideas and reading each other's proposals for funding and things like that. We had a great Christmas party one year.
But the warehouse was slated to be torn down. The entrepreneurs stuck together, though, and relocated. Soon, five companies became 20, and they needed a third, even bigger site. Today, their home is a massive old mid-19th century pipe factory in Somerville, just outside of Boston. It's called Greentown Labs.
Today, in this space, we're home to more than 50 clean energy and clean technology-focused companies and are the nation's largest clean tech incubator.
Mark Vasu is Greentown's executive vice president. He says, sure, the companies here could go out and rent office space anywhere, but these companies need space to roll up their sleeves.
They're making stuff. They're getting dirty. They're building things.
And save money doing it. If you need a power saw or an industrial press, no need to buy your own. Just sign up for a time in the machine shop. The incubator also brings shared intellectual resources, like software, human resources, even PR help. And then there's the networking. Aaron Acosta is a recent MIT grad and CEO of the five-person startup Rise Robotics, a company working on energy-efficient robotics. Acosta says they came to Greentown for the lab space, but stayed for the community.
It's like a pack effect where when someone is like pulling away and doing really well out at the front, the group can see that and then chases after it. It's like the, if they can do it, I can do it. And then if you're falling behind, then you can be like, help. And they pull you along for a little while until you're up and running again.
That help runs deep. Greentown's current roster of companies employs 450 people across a range of green tech fields. Mark Vasu points out companies as we cruise the vast space. One company is working to convert trash to energy.
Basically, landfills, when they're capped, could generate methane. If you can actually capture that methane efficiently, it can be used as a fuel source.
Another company is working on small satellites, another on energy generation from sewage. The companies are physically separated just by masking tape on the ground. One small area is empty and abandoned. That company got too big and needed more space.
Some members of the community, but Alteros Energies is making high-altitude wind turbines that are suspended up to 2,000 feet in the air through a helium sort of aerostat technology.
Of course, outgrowing the incubator is part of the point, showing there's money to be made tackling the world's climate and energy challenges. It's a growth area the state of Massachusetts is betting on, putting millions in grants and loans toward a network of green tech incubators. Stephen Pike, who runs the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center, says it's an efficient way to spend.
We can try to go out and try to support individually 50 different companies.
Or invest in an incubator that supports 50 companies under one roof. Pike says the state has an audacious goal.
We want to be the Silicon Valley of clean energy, renewable energy.
Of course, to reach that goal, the state will need some big winners. Imagine Silicon Valley without the likes of Apple, Google, or Hewlett-Packard. The Bay Area kind of loses some cachet. In Boston, the Facebook of clean energy hasn't come out of Greentown Labs yet. But my colleague Ari Daniel did find one Greentown startup that's starting to fly on its own.
Thanks, Jason. So this is the sound of an electric generator shuddering to life in Burlington, Vermont, about 200 miles north of Somerville. It's running on methane gas, brewed up by, well, a brewery next door. You might know the brewery, Magic Hat, one of Vermont's first craft breweries, which now distributes its beer around the world. Every year, Magic Hat cranks out nearly 51 million bottles of beer, and roughly a third of the electricity running the brewery comes from that methane gas. Take a tour of the brewery, and you'll hear about it yourself.
We also have an ingenious new machine known as the digester, which makes actual energy from our wastewater.
There's more waste than one would initially think.
This is Hasper Kuno of Purpose Energy.
They were trucking between 3 and 5 loads every day of their highest strength brewery waste, the stuff that really couldn't go down the drain because it would clog up the municipal wastewater system.
Getting rid of all that waste cost the brewery big money, not to mention the pollution from all those trucks. But back at the Greentown incubator, Purpose Energy was already working on a way to take waste like this from a brewery or a farm or a food production facility and convert a good chunk of it into fuel. Now, instead of getting shipped off-site for disposal, Magic Hat's wastewater gets pumped into a huge tank primed with special bacteria. The bacteria chew up the waste in the liquid and basically belch out methane gas and carbon dioxide, leaving behind cleaner water and just a small amount of goo.
This is the stuff that's floating around in the digester.
You've got like a cup full of black liquid. Oh, it's sludgy.
It's Kuno's job to clean out the digester every couple of months, and he gets covered in the stuff.
Almost head to toe.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
But the result is worth it. The digester slashes the brewery's overall carbon footprint, and the methane it produces fuels that generator we heard earlier, producing low-carbon electricity, which explains the company's name.
Not only are we making energy, but there's a purpose behind making that energy, and that purpose is a more sustainable energy future for the world.
Magic Hat was Purpose Energy's first client, taking the company from a one-person show in a garage to a small startup.
We started hiring more people and moved to Greentown Labs, a really just high-energy place for a young and budding business to grow.
And grow they did. The company got a second contract with a brewery in Delaware and will soon be working on a third digester system in Hawaii. Along the way, Purpose Energy emerged from the Somerville incubator and settled into its own new headquarters near Boston. By itself, the company won't save the world, but it's evidence that green business incubator spaces, like Greentown Labs, can help small companies make a difference, and maybe even make it big.
The World's Ari Daniel there, and before that we heard from The World's Jason Margolis. You're tuned to The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. Guatemalan singer Gaby Moreno came to the U.S. to live her dream.
I found in this country, you know, so many opportunities, and that's the experience of so many others that come here. So this is, yeah, this is where we belong.
And she puts that sentiment into song on her new album. Have a listen. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Fake game, fake champions, fake medals, Olympics of lies. That's just a small sample of what some Russians are saying on social media these days. Clearly, some there are still smarting from the punishments recently doled out to Russian athletes at the Olympics and the Paralympics. Many were not allowed to compete at the Games because of doping allegations. And so Kremlin supporters appear to have targeted the World Anti-Doping Agency, or WADA, and hacked into their computers. Shira Frankel is cybersecurity correspondent for BuzzFeed News. So what do we know about who carried out this hack, Shara, and what they got out of it?
What we know so far is just what the World Anti-Doping Agency has put out, and they're presumably working with a private cybersecurity company. They've said that this is a Russian actor, which they like to call Fancy Bear, which has been responsible for hacks on the DNC, the White House, and the State Department. This is a very, very well-known group, and they're a very successful group. They use really simple methods to get into these systems and then stay there for a long time collecting information.
So who have they released information about? What have they learned from this hack?
Well, so far we've just seen a handful of Olympic athletes affected, most notably Venus and Serena Williams and Simone Biles. I think that they, what they've said is that they, these athletes are using medicines that are banned by the Olympics. These athletes, of course, have responded by saying that those medicines were approved and that therefore they were, their use was allowed. I think it's been quite a big PR coup for them, at least within Russian news agencies. We've seen across, as you mentioned, across Russian media, this celebrated as kind of like a gotcha moment. Oh, you see these American athletes are also doping. Here in the US though, I mean, I think that mostly we've seen people sort of rally behind these athletes and ask why their medical files are being released and asking why those files weren't kept more secure.
I mean, it seems pro-Russian voices as well as the Russian media are talking about double standards, like how WADA allows drugs for medical treatments, which some say can actually enhance performance. They point to Simone Biles, a gymnast, using Adderall for ADHD, for example. Don't they have a point?
So to be honest, I don't know much about sort of the medicines that were involved and what those standards should be. I don't follow sports probably as closely as I should. I think that there certainly has proven to be a problem time and time again with the Olympics and the way that athletes are tested and the the types of medication that's tested for. I think that it's certainly something that international bodies should sit together and discuss, and some sort of standard should be upheld to, because people are losing faith in these Olympics and what they stand for. But I don't know that hacking into medical files and releasing that kind of information publicly is the right way to go about kind of calling for that sort of change.
Which leads to kind of a critical question. Why does Russia care so much about this that they would at least appear to hack WADA?
I think that the banning of their athletes from the Olympics was actually a really, really harsh blow in Russia. I think it was taken quite personally by the Russian government. And I remember around the time that this was first being discussed, reading articles in Russian papers, of course, in translation, which said that this was sort of the U.S. trying to spread its view of the world and trying to assure that its athletes reign supreme. I think it was taken personally, and that this was in reaction to that. We don't know yet whether these hackers were backed by the state, ordered to do what they did by the state. But I think there's no doubt that across Russia, this is being seen as a bit of sort of retribution for what happened to their athletes in the Olympics.
And WADA has denounced the hack as an illegal act, but I would want to know under whose law, and can there be consequences?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, these are really, really murky waters, because we don't really have in the world of sort of cyber and cyber espionage, attribution is really, really difficult. Whoever's investigating these hacks can point to Russia and say, well, we have sort of with 80% assurance, we can tell you that this was Russia. But 80% assurance isn't going to hold up in a court of law. And as you said, which court of law does that even go to? We're in sort of strange times now where governments are starting to sort of point fingers and say, perhaps this was Russia, perhaps it was China. But no one feels confident in saying definitively that one country or another was behind these types of hacks. And if you can't say it definitively, if you're not holding the evidence in your hand, how do you ever take anyone to task?
Shira Frankel, cybersecurity correspondent for BuzzFeed News. Thank you.
Thank you.
Another tech story now. Drones often get a bad rap. Weapons of war, tools for surveillance. But a former refugee from Afghanistan is working to change that image, at least a little bit. His name is Mehdi Salehi, and he's developing ways to use drone technology to help with the rescue efforts for migrants in the Mediterranean. Salehi's dubbed the project Drones for Refugees.
What we're trying to do with drones is to spot the exact locations where there's a problem with a boat, and we transfer all these data to the search and rescue professionals with no delay to try to help refugees and prevent losing lives.
And so once the drone is flying out over the sea, what kind of data is it going to be picking up? What will be helpful?
It's going to be real-time footage, video footage, the GPS coordinates, and as well as how many women, how many men, and how many children. So this information in real-time and sharing those, this is very crucial, I think, and that's what we're doing.
Have you been able to send any of these drones out on any test flights yet and see the results?
Yes.
What did you find out?
We did a minimal deployment. We spotted one boat. We didn't want to go very close. We didn't want to scare him. We didn't know how would be the result. If we didn't want to have any bad outcomes by this first try. But afterwards, we did fly our drones close to refugees, and we interviewed them. We wanted to understand their feelings and how they would feel if by seeing a drone flying close to them.
This is all very personal to you, I know. I mean, you were yourself a teenage refugee from Afghanistan. How did that factor into this project?
Well, this story comes from 15 years ago when I was a teenager, wanted to cross from Turkey to Greece. A friend of mine and I, we bought a small plastic boat for $20, and we tried to cross the sea on a winter cold night. That was a horrible situation. We didn't know if we would get there alive, but we were lucky. I can't really describe, but it's darkness underneath. It's dark everywhere. You literally are by yourself, and there's no hope. If there's something goes wrong, you don't know if anyone can help. That helped me to come up. It helped the inspiration for the project.
And I'm curious, when you crossed over from Turkey to Greece 15 years ago, how do you think a drone might have helped you?
So it was a friend of mine and I, he got sick. He couldn't actually paddle. So I was kind of by myself. There were giant waves and there was literally no one to help. It was dark and we didn't have cell phones. We couldn't communicate with anyone. So we could literally have died that night. A drone, if we had seen a drone, we would know that there was someone behind that drone. There's a human being that is watching us. So if they didn't have bad intentions, help us if they wanted to. Absolutely, for myself, would be a good thing to have a drone. And if something goes wrong, I knew that there are people that they can see us and help us.
Did you ever at the time dream that one day you would be in a position to help refugees, that you would be doing that?
No, I wouldn't imagine. I think that I wanted that night was to get somewhere safe and to stay alive. That's the only thing that I wanted that night. The same thing is happening 15 years later and in a larger scale. And unfortunately, people are dying. So that was kind of surreal.
Mm. With the one difference being you've got this little tool now that will be able to help them.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a tool that we're working hard on leveraging this technology for social good. And I think absolutely drones are very, very useful for helping refugees.
Mehdi Salehi, thank you very much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Mehdi Salehi is the founder of the Drones for Refugees project. He spoke with us from New York. Tennis fans, you'll probably recognize this. Roger Federer and Rafa Nadal having a little fun there. You wouldn't know it from the grunting and screaming. It is part and parcel of high-level tennis, though. Even occasional shouts like Nadal's famous Vamos, let's go, in Spanish. But a few years ago when Allegra Hanlon shouted Vamos during a juniors tournament in Michigan, she was surprised by the response from the officials. Hanlon's a junior at Cornell University, where she plays on the tennis team. So what happened, Allegra, at that tournament?
Well, I had won an important point. And in a moment of elation, I said, vamos, which is a word that means come on in Spanish. It's a word I've grown up using my entire life. And next thing I know, an official runs over to where I'm standing and he says, point penalty, Hanlon. No speaking in other languages.
Is there an actual rule book that says you can't speak foreign languages on the court?
Yes. There is a USTA handbook that has a rule that says if a player engages in loud outbursts in a language that the official doesn't understand, the official needs to caution the player that if they speak again in a loud outburst in the foreign language, you will be penalized.
Did you actually have a warning that day?
I had a warning, but what really got to me was the fact that I was speaking to myself. And I didn't even say it loudly at that time, you know? And not only that, but I was in the heat of the moment in the middle of the match. And it's only natural. Mm. So I almost like forgot about it. And then the second time was in a moment of pure elation. I was so excited that I won the point and that I was up a game and closer to winning the match. And I said, vamos. It's just, it's a positive word. It's not a negative word. And he came over and he just gave me the point penalty.
Did you manage to make it up and win the match?
No, I didn't. I lost the point. I lost the game. I lost some momentum, and then I lost the match.
So that's a U.S. Tennis Association rule. Is the same rule applied internationally?
Actually, if you look up the rules in the NCAA in general for college sports, it does not apply. But in the ITA, the Tennis Association of College Tennis, it does apply. and you're not allowed to speak in a foreign language. Internationally, in the US Open, it does not apply because, of course, tennis is a universal sport. And if that were the case, then nobody would understand each other.
So you grew up in Miami. Your mom's Colombian. Your father's Irish-American. Was Spanish your first language? Did you speak it at home growing up?
Spanish was my first language. Miami is pretty much could be a Latin American city because of the amount of different cultures that merged together there from Latin America. And my parents raised me for Spanish to be my first language because they think it's vitally important in a world, you know, that's growing smaller every day with the amount of technology we have to be able to speak more than one language.
Now, prejudice against Spanish hasn't affected just you on the court, but I gather also for your mom when she was in the stands.
My mom, she would often say vamos to me in encouragement. Every time we went to a tournament, especially in the northeastern states, she would be reprimanded. So there was actually this one occasion where we were in Akron, Ohio, and I was the only, I think, Latin American player in that tournament. And my mom, at one point, I won an important point, and she said, vamos, Allegra. And a father came over to her from the other side of the stands and said, go back to Mexico,
where you came from.
And that was just, she was scared. They had to call a couple of officials to come and tell them to, like, move away from her, please. I asked her about this the other day. I asked her how much it affected her, and she said that it got to the point where she wouldn't say anything at all. And there was a sadness in her voice that definitely reminded me of the impact that all this has had on us.
So how has these experiences changed the way you play your game?
It definitely has affected my demeanor on the court. For a while, just like my mom, I didn't say anything. I was afraid to even open my mouth because the words that might come out might be in a foreign language and I would be reprimanded and penalized and be put down again.
You wrote about all this in an editorial for the Washington Post. Allegra, have you tried to get the rule overturned?
I have not. But what moved me to write this article in the first place was that I was looking up the results of the US Open and I thought about how cool it is that this is a tournament in the United States that brings together these incredible tennis players from all over the world in a celebration of their differences and their language and cultures to create tennis, which is a universal sport in itself. And then I started thinking about the elections and all the discrimination that there is surrounding Latin Americans. And I remembered my incident and I thought it would be a story that was really relevant and people would care about right now.
Well, we really appreciate your telling us about it. Allegra Hanlon at Cornell University, where she is on the tennis team. Allegra, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get to the break, let's take a quick look at tomorrow's show. We'll head to Indonesia's capital, Jakarta, which faces massive flooding problems. It's partly from rising sea levels, but right now it's mostly because of decades of rampant development.
So it is really a problem on top of another problem, making things even more difficult.
Jakarta has big plans to deal with the flooding, but it will mean displacing tens of thousands of poor residents. People working on the problem say it's the best of a lot of bad options.
So the lesson for other cities is act while you still can, and then you can avoid these mega engineering solutions.
Jakarta searches for answers to rising water. That's tomorrow here on The World. We're going to spend a few minutes with Gaby Moreno. She's a singer-songwriter from Guatemala City. Won a Grammy for Best New Artist 3 years ago. An honor for sure, but a little weird for an artist who'd already been working for more than 15 years. The truth is that Gaby always seems to be a new artist, reinventing herself constantly. No surprise, then, that her new album combines a bunch of different stylistic elements.
Algo en mí cambió. Me dijo que es mejor olvidarlo y dejarlo, que fue un baile efímero.
Gaby Moreno, welcome.
Thank you so much.
I know your life has taken you through a lot of musical territory, but I got to say, the first song which you featured on the album, it's on the album twice, in Spanish as Se Apagó and in English as Love Is Gone, sounds like a Memphis Stax session in the 60s. Big happy surprise with the horn section just ripping it up. So let's start there. When did you discover soul?
Well, I discovered blues when I was 13 years old, when I came from Guatemala to New York with my family just on vacation, and I heard it there for the first time. So that led to me discovering, you know, all the other styles that sort of come from the blues. So I started listening to jazz and to soul and to R&B, and it kind of went from there and never looked back.
And this this song appears on the album two times, in Spanish and English, as I said. Yeah. Why is that?
Well, yeah, it's kind of funny because in the past I remember saying that I didn't like translating songs. So This is a lesson to never say never. And then what I did was I wrote the song in Spanish first. And then I had the idea of doing this as a duet, and I wanted to do it with an artist that I love from Nashville, a soul artist by the name of Johnny P. And so, of course, he doesn't speak Spanish, so I thought, well, you know what? This is going to be interesting. I'm going to try and translate this. And, I did it, and I asked him if he wanted to sing it with me, and he said yes. Something's lost, but something's gained. Now it's time to walk away.
I want to ask you about another song, too, on the album, Fronteras, which is the word for borders in Spanish, but it could be a metaphor. Maybe it's more literal. I don't know. As in the borders you cross as a Latina coming to America? What are you talking about?
I wrote the song specifically about Latin American people living in the United States and how we are stuck in between two worlds. Hay un camino que nos trajo hasta aquí. No conoce las fronteras, esta pasión dentro de mí. You know, we keep our traditions, we're kind of faithful to our roots from wherever we come from, but at the same time, we're sort of straddling the fence because we're here in the States, and then we've adopted, you know, new customs and from the American culture. And I've been here almost 16 years, and I see this with, you know, other Latin people that I know that have been here for so many years. So the word borders actually came from not putting borders inside of you, you know. La esperanza nos acompaña, con ella nada nos puede detener. Yo de tu mano, tú de la mía, no hay nada que temer. Y río y bailo, está en mis venas, y libre sueño, this is where I I feel like, you know, this is where I'm at. This is where my dreams and aspirations are. I came here with my dream of making music. I found in this country, you know, so many opportunities, and that's the experience of so many others that come here. So, you know, this is where we belong.
And you came here on a student visa, came to the U.S. on a student visa.
Yeah.
What did you do? You were studying, but what did you do when that ran out?
Oh, I applied for an artist visa, which is it's called an O-1. So I got that, and you get that if you can prove that you've done, you know, you've had a musical career in your country. So, you know, I've been singing in Guatemala since I was 10 years old, so I was able to prove that.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed with the artist visa for about 6 years, and then I actually applied for a green card, and I got it about 5 years ago. So now I'm on the path to becoming a citizen. Which,
congratulations.
Thank you. I still haven't applied for it, but yeah, I'm getting there.
Does that feel good?
It does. It does, man. I mean, I've been here so many years that It's kind of strange to think that, you know, almost half of my life I've been here, because my whole family is still in Guatemala, so it still feels a little strange. And in a sort of a weird way, I still feel 100% Guatemalan, even though I'm here. But I'm getting to that point where, yes, I'm gonna have to, you know, start calling myself like kind of Guatemalan American, because, yeah, it's been a while.
One more thing, Gabby. I know we said you won a Grammy for Best New Artist 3 years ago, but you had been working much longer than that. In fact, one of your first gigs, you were singing backup as a kid for Ricky Martin in Guatemala.
My dad was an artist promoter, and he brought our Ricky Martin to Guatemala. So I opened for him when I was 10 years old.
What was that like?
It was, you know, everyone thinks like, oh, I was so, you know, I must have been so nervous, but I was actually really, really excited. And after I came off stage, I saw him and I said, "Hey, Ricky, don't worry, the audience is awesome. Like I left them, you know, like they're really excited to see you."
Did he have any good advice for you for your future career as a singer-songwriter?
No, it was so brief, that moment that I saw him and just, you know, said hi to him, gave him a hug. That was it.
Shared
a picture with him.
Shared a Coke in the green room?
Right. I do have a picture with him, so that was fun.
Gaby Moreno, her new album is titled Ilusión. Gaby, thanks very much for being with us today. I really enjoyed this.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Algo en mí cambió.
Me dijo que es mejor olvidar. That's music from singer-songwriter Gaby Moreno, putting some delightful finishing touches on the show today. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow. Dicen por allí que ya no me ven sonreír. Es un mal que poco a poco va dejando su impresión. PRI, Public Radio International.